This week's addendum is brought to you by Stamps.com. Mailing and shipping can seem like a no-win situation. The post office takes way too much time, and a postage meter is really expensive. Fortunately, there's a better way, Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. You get a 4-week trial plus $110 in a bonus offer, which includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the page and type in undisclosed. That's stamps.com and enter undisclosed. Hi, and welcome to the 14th addendum of Undisclosed, the State versus Adnan Syed. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and national security fellow, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. I'm joined with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Volkov Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs at The View from LL2. Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor of the Evidence Prof blog. Now, this week, we are going to answer a lot of questions that we've gotten about Christina Gutierrez from our last episode. But before we do that, we have a little something extra about an issue we touched on a few weeks ago. Remember the state cell phone expert, Mr. Abe Boronowitz, the one who gave Adnan's legal team an affidavit that was included in their latest filing just in the last few weeks? Well, he's been gracious enough to speak to Susan at length about everything he remembers from that time. From when he was asked to do the drive test that the state used at trial, and also the time he testified in person at the second trial. He had a lot of interesting things to tell Susan, and one of the most interesting things to me is how that drive test actually took place and who was along with him for the ride. So let's see what Susan has to say.
We were hoping to have a special episode for you guys this week, not about Christina Gutierrez, but about something else entirely, the cell phone expert's testimony. I spoke at length to Abe Boronowitz, the state cell expert, the one who wrote the affidavit recently that was filed with Adnan's latest brief. He told me all kinds of things regarding AT&T's Baltimore network in 1999, his role in Adnan's case, and his role in the current appeal, and also about the now infamous fax cover sheet and why it says incoming calls are even more unreliable than outgoing calls when it comes to predicting a phone's location. He had a lot of interesting things to say, so much so that we had a whole episode prepared to cover it. Unfortunately, you guys don't get to hear the episode yet. The reality is, the case we're covering is a very active one, and these issues may play a prominent role in the upcoming proceedings. So, while I'm selfishly disappointed for myself that we can't air it yet, it's been decided to hold back for now from making any public comments about Boronowitz's role in the case regarding the issues currently before the court until those matters have been resolved. So there's no way to know right now when that might be, but once that part of the case is no longer active, we'll be able to hear from him. Here's what I can say for now. As an attorney, I find Boronowitz's role as an expert witness to be probably one of the most fascinating untold stories in this case. Technically, Boronowitz was the state's expert, but his role was nothing like how expert witnesses are in 99% of cases. In fact, his experience was much more like that of a typical fact witness, uncertain about court procedures, nervous about dealing with lawyers, and wishing that he could be just about anywhere else on earth rather than on the witness stand. Because expert witnesses are, in the overwhelming majority of cases, informed from the beginning that they are going to be an expert witness, and they're almost always paid for their trouble. Boronowitz wasn't. When Boronowitz conducted his drive test, he had no idea that later on he'd be asked to testify about it in a murder trial. The whole thing was pretty informal at the time. He went to meet Murphy, Urich, and Jay, and the four of them drove around, conducted tests at a handful of places in western Baltimore, which Jay pointed at. In fact, at the time, Boronowitz thought he was there to help with an investigation, not preparing for a case at trial. He didn't take any notes and simply read out results to the prosecutors, because he had no idea he'd be expected to stand up to direct and cross-examination about this testing just a few months later. But even though the prosecutors hadn't asked him to record anything, after the drive test, he went back to his office and printed out the results from his testing, since his computer had recorded it automatically, and he figured why not. The prosecution ultimately used two of those maps at trial. Maps that, unfortunately, didn't actually show any of the areas where criminal activity had taken place. Those were, just to remind y'all, the Gilston Park area, where Jay never testified he went, and Kathy's apartment. But in addition to those two maps, Wernowitz had actually brought all of his maps with him to trial when he came to testify, just to be prepared. He brought other documents, too. Ones he showed the prosecution that, you know, for instance, showed additional phone calls had been made on the day of the murder, but the prosecutors didn't want to use them. This is just another example of the tragedies in this case involving lost information. This was more data that could have been had, but wasn't, because the attorneys involved didn't even take basic steps to preserve it. Had Wernowitz known what would be asked of him, he could have prepared a report of his drive testing, and prepared a report in general of the things he would testify to at trial. But even though he wasn't told that and wasn't given a chance to prepare, he still had some of the data saved and right there in the courtroom with him, but no one ever asked for it. Yet another opportunity missed. As for the particulars of what Wernowitz did and what he found, that'll have to wait for later. But if you have any remaining questions about the role of the cell phone evidence in this case, I promise it'll be addressed then.
Well, we're going to be hearing a lot more from Abe Wernowitz and issues surrounding the cell phone testimony and the science itself in future episodes. But we've gotten a lot of great feedback on our last episode, Tina. And so we're going to answer some questions related to that episode now.
This question comes from Anne Stelling. Her Twitter handle is @AnneStelling. She asks, when did Anon hire Gutierrez? Why the change in representation? The answer is that when Anon was initially arrested, he was represented by Chris Floor and Doug Colbert. They were attorneys with the Lawyers at Bail Project. And thereafter, on April 18th, 1999, upon the recommendation of Chris Floor, Christina Gutierrez was hired. And so after we aired last week's episode, I decided to reach out to Chris Floor to get his insight into the transition, as well as to discuss with him an interesting document I found in the defense files. And so here's the interview I did with Chris Floor. What did you know about Gutierrez when you recommended her to Anand's family?
I had recently moved from New York, probably months just before Adnan's case had begun. He was charged. And I knew Tina through the NACDL, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. She was on the board of directors, and I later learned that she had to sort of claw her way onto the board because there was no representation from women at the time, and she had to find some obscure thing in the rules that allowed her to petition her way onto the board. She was really active in NACDL, and I learned about her through some other attorneys that I knew, and I just found out that she had, you know, just an unbelievably strong reputation for being a very, very aggressive criminal defense attorney and trial attorney. By the time I moved to the state, then I started hearing some of the other stories about Tina, and I can't say that this one's necessarily 100% true because I never talked to her about it. I mean, I became friends with Tina. I actually asked Tina for a job at one point when I was moving from New York to Maryland, and she was always very, very helpful to me in talking about the practice of law and insight and so forth. But the legend was that Tina would be on trial, and because she was sick, she would vomit into a Ziploc bag that she carried with her, put it into her briefcase, and then continue on with the trial. And now that I'm 25 years into my practice, as opposed to like 8-10 years into my practice back then, I really thought that that showed that she was as tough as nails. And I looked up to that and thought that that was really a good thing. And now, you know, knowing that we lost her at such a young age, I think, you know, she just didn't have the balance that she needed. And I think that that's a real cautionary tale that I share with other lawyers and other folks in the profession. And another thing I can remember in terms of her dedication was, this is probably pre-Adnan's case, but because I had, you know, become friendly with her and was talking to her, we were talking one night at, you know, probably probably midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning on the phone, and she thought it was a great thing that I was still awake and available to talk about cases. And, you know, other colleagues were already, and folks that were on her, you know, staff, I guess the law students and so forth, were, you know, asleep already.
Yeah, and as you were just discussing, she certainly did seem to have this hard and powerful drive, but also these sort of health issues. And, you know, at the time you recommended her, she seemed to have a sterling reputation. But then obviously there were the issues in Adnan's case, and then eventually her disbarment and all the client claims against her. What did you think as this sort of unwound in real time when you saw this once titan of the legal field basically having all these claims brought against her for malpractice and in some cases embezzlement?
Yeah, I'd say that my, you know, reaction, and I had visited Tina one time in the hospital, you know, and we were, and other folks that went there with me were asking her to slow down and to take better care of herself. And then she seemed to rebound, and I really had no idea when she went into the trials how bad things must have been now, you know, with all the information we've gotten. But when, you know, this person, and I think the good word that you used is titan, she really was a titan, for her to not only, you know, not put up a fight, but to concede and allow them and say she just wasn't healthy enough to fight, you know, for her license. So it's just inconceivable to me and the Tina that I knew and respected. And it was profoundly sad to see somebody, you know, go down the tubes like that. And I'd say to this day, I still have a tough time, you know, with somebody who I respected and held up in such high regard, that she could actually not only just, you know, slip on cases and get overwhelmed, but to actually, you know, take money from clients or to do things that, you know, from the number of complaints I've now learned about taking money from folks and not actually doing the work that she said she would do. That's a tough one. And it's just really profoundly sad. I think Professor Warnken's comments, you know, in the last episode that you did were something that I share in that I really do believe that there was so much more to this person. And it's a shame that, you know, a number of my colleagues, you know, when she passed, and I actually attended Tina's funeral, and I was upset. I remember being upset that not very many people came out from the legal community because she was such a giant. And I felt that we kind of owed it to her in honoring her, you know, our legacy to the criminal defense bar, but many other folks had said, you know, well, she was a thief, you know, and I don't want to talk about it, you know, there's nothing to talk about with her. And I just thought that there was a lot more to her, and I saw her do some pretty amazing things for folks.
Yeah, and it seemed like she had a great reputation as a trial attorney, and her performances there in the courtroom. I find it interesting because recently I found the document where you recommended her to Adnan's family. And what I found interesting was the recommendation wasn't just for her. In the recommendation, it says Mark Martin / Tina G. And so I was wondering, how do you know Mark Martin? Why did you recommend him as part of this sort of team? And what role do you think that he would have played in this case?
Yeah, Mark and I started at Legal Aid Society in New York back in 1990 together. We were in the same training class. And he worked in a different borough. He worked in Manhattan. I worked in Brooklyn. But we became friendly, and I thought highly of his skills then. And then Mark had moved down to Maryland earlier than I did. When I learned that he was in her firm, that certainly made me feel even more comfortable about recommending, you know, the best person we possibly could, or the best team of folks that we possibly could. As you know, you were kind enough to send me that document that I haven't looked at for a number of years now. But, you know, in looking at the names I was jotting down there about the best investigator that was available out there, the best defense attorney, trial attorneys, criminal defense trial attorneys that were in the town, because remember, I was still a fairly new guy, you know, to this neck of the woods. So, Mark definitely made me feel comfortable. In fact, you know, since leaving, you know, Tina's firm, Mark has got his own practice, and I've remained in touch with him, and he's been a tremendous colleague, and I've referred, you know, cases to him over time, and I think very, very highly of him.
Yeah, and I was also looking through the defense files recently and saw that Mark, really in the early stages of the representation, had a pretty big role to play. He was there at the first meeting with Gutierrez and Adnan. He actually met alone with Adnan after that by himself. and he was doing a lot of the legwork. But then in July 1999, sort of just as the case was gearing up in pretrial prep, he left the firm. And I've written about this a bit in my blog. It was mainly law students, as far as I can tell, who were clerking, who took over the duties that he was handling. And I wonder, you know, obviously you have not that firsthand knowledge, but what effect do you think that had in terms of prepping the case?
Yeah, I think it was pretty significant because, you know, knowing how in demand Tina was and how many folks wanted to have her as the person, you know, dealing with their case, then that required a really strong base back at the home office of getting the scut work done and the preparation done. And I know Mark, and I know that he's that kind of guy that you would be able to rely on to do that. I don't to this day know the circumstances of why he left, but I'm sure that having him leave the team, you know, was a pretty big deal. And I remember also back then when I was, you know, friendly with Tina and see her at the criminal defense attorney meetings that we would attend together, that Rita Pazniokas was another pretty important person, you know, to the team. And I know that sometime later she also left the firm. And, you know, that was unfortunate.
Our next Twitter question comes from Ms. Crafty Annie, whose Twitter handle is MSLeader62. And she asks, what other cases did Cristina Gutierrez handle in the years prior to Adnan's? Because her history is in question with me.
One case she handled throughout 1996 was the case of Jane DaCosta, who assisted with a murder in 1995 when she was 16 years old. After last week's episode, a former Baltimore Sun reporter got in touch with us and told us about when she'd been reporting on the DaCosta case and her interactions with Gutierrez at that time. I interviewed her, and here's what she said about what she recalled about Gutierrez during that time period.
I'm here with Elaine Tassi, a former reporter with the Baltimore Sun, who met Cristina Gutierrez as she was working on the court beat in the mid-90s in Baltimore County.
Thank you so much for having me on, Susan. I was working as a reporter at the Baltimore Sun from 94 to 98. And part of that time, I was covering Baltimore County Circuit Court. So Baltimore County, as you know, of course, is like a donut around surrounding Baltimore City. So that jurisdiction was much less likely to have murder trials. Rather, there were like maybe 75 murders a year in Baltimore County as compared to like 300 plus in Baltimore City. So I was covering trials that occurred, or rather that were tried in Baltimore County based on crimes that obviously occurred there as well. And so one of the trials that I ended up covering was that of Jane Frances DaCosta, and she was represented by Cristina Gutierrez. So that case pertained to a teenage girl who was an accomplice to a known mentally ill teenage boy who was also her boyfriend. And the murder was extremely, extremely graphically described in his confession, where he was bragging about like jumping up and down on top of her body after he had stabbed her multiple times. And he didn't even know her. He was in a locked mental hospital. So she helped him by giving him the knife that he used to end up stabbing her. So after he stabbed her, the girlfriend, Jane, picked him up in her father's car, and then they fled to Virginia, and they were on the lam for a couple weeks until they got caught in a 7-Eleven where they had been trying to steal some cigarettes or some candy or something like that. So then when they got picked up and brought back to Maryland, they both gave very detailed confessions. So Jane Frances DaCosta's parents hired Cristina Gutierrez to represent her. He was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole at the age of 16, which was pretty unusual. And then Jane's trial came up maybe 4 or 5 months later, and Cristina was representing her. And Jane was not bailed out when she had been picked up in Virginia. When they took her back to Maryland, her parents didn't give the bail money because Jane was a habitual runaway. So they figured, all right, let's just leave her in the jail until the trial comes up. So all the while that Christina was preparing to represent Jane, she would be going to the jail to have to talk to her because she was not at home, just like the situation with Adnan. I remember when they were in the pretrial phase that Christina was in the hospital quite a bit. And I had a really, really good editor at the time. I think he still works at the Baltimore Sun, named David Rosenthal. And so I told him, you know, that I was trying to talk to Christina about something and she was in the hospital. And he was like, so call her at the hospital. I remember, like, when I would get home from work, I had tried, after having spent the day, like, trying to reach her and not being successful and not really getting anywhere with any of her staff people, I just called her up in the hospital. And she was never the type of person who was very elaborate or very, you know, she was not chatty. She was not the sort of person who would inform you of, like, the details of a case or give you background or... you know, indulge you in the type of conversation as a reporter would be looking for. She was more the type who would just answer questions with a yes or no or with a very factual statement. But I don't remember her being a friendly person. I remember her being more so like all business. And she was very, very, very busy. And she was always seeming like she had a million different things on her plate at one time. And the fact that she ended up losing Adnan's case and experiencing a lot of depression afterwards, which I remember hearing on the podcast, isn't surprising to me because I know that she really seemed to take the cases that she worked on very seriously and very personally. And you could tell that she had a lot of trial strategy. I remember like hearing her voice for the first time on Serial and immediately just recognizing that tone that she uses and the very, very loud volume that she speaks in. And she was doing that in the Jane Frances DaCosta case also.
So the DaCosta case was 97, 98?
No, I think it was more like 96.
96?
Yeah, I think the event happened in 1996, and then the trial was in either later that year or in the beginning of 97. But I know it wasn't 98 because by then I was not covering court anymore.
The voice that you heard on Serial sounded to you about the same as you heard her in trial back then?
Yes, absolutely. The voice that she speaks in court, that's her real voice. It's not like she just puts that on for the jury.
Did you ever hear anyone remark on how she talked, or if it was a new thing, if it was a change in her prior behavior, or is that just her known style?
Yeah, I think that's just her known style. I don't think it changed as a result of her health or anything. I think from day one, that's how she came across. And I think that that was to her advantage in a lot of ways, because somebody who's like shy and flowery and, you know, easy to intimidate might not have been as effective as she, because of all of the defense lawyers that I remember from that time period, she was probably easily within like the top five. Christina would be somebody who, like, if he weren't available, I would certainly consider her to represent me, because I know she had a really good record of wins, which, as you guys know, of course, is not very common. Because a lot of the murder trials ended up in convictions. Her getting Jane off or getting her sent to Devereaux was like mind-blowingly shocking because of all the details in that case. So she was like almost like a rock star during that period. And the fact that she was selected by Adnan's family, I think that was probably a very well thought out consideration, you know what I mean? Because there are like maybe 10 lawyers in the Baltimore area who do criminal defense who are very well known to this day, like including Billy Murphy. So I really think that when they decided on her, they were fortunate to get her to agree to represent him because she was very highly sought after.
She did. She had an amazing record for a criminal defense attorney doing murder trials in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually the first person I've spoken to who has mentioned Gutierrez being in the hospital that early on. Mm-hmm. Do you recall at all how long she was in there for or what she was there for?
I'm sure she wouldn't have shared it with me, but Her hospitalization and the reason for it wasn't known to anybody that I knew either. So I didn't know what she was in the hospital for. And I remember when I would talk to her in the hospital, she was sounding as though she had like all of her law books and files right there on her hospital bed or something. Because when I would call her up, I think I only reached her once. And I had tried her more than once, though. And I would think, like, if I were to call somebody in the hospital, they would act like, you know, look, I'm in the hospital now. Can you leave me alone? But she didn't seem to care. She didn't seem to mind. I don't think I was the only person who called her there, because she wasn't acting as though this was out of the ordinary for her. You know, like, sometimes there are lawyers or lawyers' associates who make a point of cultivating relationships with reporters so that then, you know, we'll know who they are, we'll be interested in talking to them when they have a case that's of interest. But in her case, she didn't really use the media to her advantage. She just sort of dealt with people who asked questions of her as they came.
So Gutierrez was in the hospital as early as 1996. We don't know why or how long she was there, but clearly it was for significant amounts of time if it was actually interfering with her trial work to the point where her associates had to handle cases instead.
That takes us to the next Twitter question, which is from Lola, whose Twitter handle is Lola Olola. And Lola says, not getting enough rest exacerbates symptoms of MS. And her schedule, meaning Christina Gutierrez's schedule, shows that she was not getting rest. Now, I wish we knew more about Gutierrez's condition back in 1999 and 2000. In addition to what we reported in episode 14, the only other information we've been able to find out is this, that on April 12th, 1999, Gutierrez was set to represent Kenneth Healy at his rape trial. Here's a notation from the Maryland case search. Defendant's attorney ill. Case must be tried on next trial date. Defendant's attorney physically unable to try case must have alternate counsel available. We don't know anything beyond this, but it certainly seems like Gutierrez had something more than a garden variety illness. Now, here's something we do know. Gutierrez's schedule before Adnan's first scheduled trial, which was supposed to start Wednesday, October 13th. And this is what her schedule looked like in the 2 weeks leading up to that scheduled trial date. From October 1st to the 4th, she had a business trip to South Carolina. From October 5th to 6th, there was the Damon Richardson trial in Baltimore County. And now this is an interesting one because Richardson was charged with armed robbery and related crimes. He had a first trial in May, but that trial ended early when Gutierrez successfully moved for a mistrial. We don't know the reason for the mistrial being declared, but it's very strange for Gutierrez to have two mistrials in the span of 6 months because trials are rare. About 95% of cases end with pleas. Mistrials are even more rare. According to the National Center for State Courts, only 4% of trials end in non-hung jury mistrials. Regardless, after the mistrial in May, Richardson was preliminarily denied bail. A hearing was then scheduled for June 1st to review the bail issue. And here's a notation from the state court website. Counsel fails to appear. Bail status remains the same. We don't know why Gutierrez failed to appear or send anyone in her place. What we do know is that the trial was rescheduled for October 5th, and Gutierrez had trial on that day and on the 6th. She apparently had an arrangement with the court because the trial was put on hold after these first 2 days so that Gutierrez could then go to Puerto Rico. Moving on, the next 2 days, October 7th and 8th, Gutierrez was in Puerto Rico for the Acosta Martinez case. This is the case that decided whether the Federal Death Penalty Act applies in Puerto Rico. It's also the case in which the First Circuit eventually concluded that it does, after Gutierrez failed to file a brief on this issue of first impression. A few listeners have asked us whether this case is still good law and has allowed the death penalty in Puerto Rico. The answer is yes, although no defendant has yet actually been given the death sentence there. Acosta Martinez himself was eventually acquitted, with another attorney representing him at trial. Now, October 9th and 10th were Saturday and Sunday, and the 11th was Columbus Day, so the courts were closed, and Richardson's trial didn't restart. It was on this day that Gutierrez moved for a continuance, with this motion being filed the next day on the 12th, 1 day before Adnan's case was scheduled to start. On that same day, October 12th, the Richardson trial picked back up, It continued into the next day, October 13th, and the case quickly ended with the jury finding Richardson guilty. As a result of the Richardson case extending into the 13th, Gutierrez isn't present to argue for a continuance in Adnan's case. And here's a note about what happens from the defense files. It's a memorandum dated October 13th, 1999, addressed to Christina Gutierrez from another attorney in the firm, and it says that the postponement has been denied by Judge Kenneth Johnson. Request to hold the case until you are finished, 2 or 2:30, denied. Would not recommend that it be reset for argument on the motion to continue before Judge Quarles. Ordered that the case be stacked in Judge Quarles' court per Urich's request.
As of 1 p.m. on October 14th, the decision was made not to continue with the trial on that date. We have a letter from Gutierrez to one of the witnesses saying that, that they didn't know until 1 p.m. that day that the trial would not be continuing. Thereafter, the trial was rescheduled for October 18th. However, on the 18th, they once again delayed it for unknown reasons to December, early December, and then eventually they delayed it again until the second week of December. We're not sure why, but as of the morning of October 14th, it was full steam ahead. Gutierrez would have thought for sure that she was going to trial that day.
Yeah, what that means is basically the 2 weeks heading up to Adnan's first planned trial, she had business in South Carolina a few days, was doing a potential death penalty case in Puerto Rico for a few days, had a separate trial in Maryland that she lost pretty quickly with a jury verdict. So it's hard to imagine those 2 weeks in October, her doing much, if any, trial prep in Adnan's case. And it's just, to me, unreasonable that you would have a murder case, a first-degree murder case, with this amount of other litigation in various jurisdictions leading up to the trial.
Yeah, and as of October 12th, we have an associate with her law firm writing her memorandums about interviews with Adnan and giving new information from Adnan about matters of importance, what was going on that day, what Adnan recalled about who he called that day, and she would have just been learning about it the day before the scheduled trial date.
And there's another file in the defense files about Gutierrez, I think either on the 14th or the 15th, having business in D.C. and the judge telling her to be on call because the case very well could have gone to trial right then. So it was not a done deal at all that this case would be continued until December.
So one question that comes up a number of times, and it's probably because of some of the comments I've made in the past about Gutierrez and her demeanor towards the family and myself, is that, you know, can you talk a little bit about that? And one of the questions we got is from Mona, whose Twitter handle is Mo Silky Mo. And she says, can you elaborate on why you were terrified when interacting with Gutierrez? Now, I didn't meet Gutierrez until the second trial. And at that point, Adnan's family, his parents specifically, had asked that I accompany them to her office for a meeting. I went to two different meetings, from what I recall. And, you know, I went in because they wanted me to ask questions that they were nervous asking her. And they wanted me to just kind of understand what was really going on in the case, what was the strategy, and, you know, explain these things to them, basically. So I walked in with them, you know, legal pad in hand with my questions handy and their questions handy. And we never got around to that. Gutierrez walked in like a storm, I remember, and was like, who are you? Why are you here? I don't have to answer your questions. I mean, I was a law student. She was very intimidating to me, intimidating, I think, in general. And I just really was there, not questioning her legal acumen, but just because the family had asked me. But, you know, she didn't answer any questions. She literally said, I don't have to answer to any of you. Adnan is my client. I'm not responding to you. And I remember distinctly that the first meeting, she dispensed with all of that within, I think, the first minute. And then she said, we need to talk about money. And I need $5,000 to take the jury to the burial site. And so Adnan's father opened up the checkbook and wrote out a check for $5,000. I think I still actually have that check. And he wrote in the comment, the notation that, you know, bust the jury or something like that. But so, you know, he wrote a check. She talked a little bit more about money and then she left. And that was it. So after that, I think I went to another meeting in which I didn't say anything. I just sat there because I wanted to be able to just if his parents had questions afterwards, maybe clarify anything they didn't understand. And my last interaction ever with her was the day that Adnan was convicted. We left the courtroom and we were all in tears. I was with his mom and I believe his younger brother was with us. And we ran into Gutierrez as we were all entering the elevator, and we got in the elevator together, and she said nothing about the conviction. She didn't say, "I'm sorry, we'll fix this, don't worry." All she said was, "I will need $50,000 more for an appeal." And that was it. And then the elevator opened and she left. So she was just very intimidating. And it seems like it just wasn't me, right? I mean, even this lady you spoke to, this reporter, Elaine, also sounds like she felt kind of intimidated by her too.
Yeah, she had a similar reaction to Gutierrez's presence that you did and found her quite intimidating.
I mean, Christina was working all kinds of hours. I remember this one time after I had stayed late at work and I went to the grocery store and I saw her in there. And I was thinking, like, should I go over and say hi to her, you know, like while she's looking for, you know, her ice cream or whatever. And I felt like, no, if I did, she'd probably turn around and like scratch me or something. She just didn't seem like the type of person where if you bumped into her outside of the job, you know, that she'd want to have a little chit chat the way that a lot of other like attorneys and stuff that I came to know very casually at work. Like if I bumped into them in my spare time, I'd usually chat with them. But in her case, that was not something I felt like I had any business doing.
Yeah, when I was talking to Abe Wernowitz, the cell phone expert, he kind of had a similar story as well. He told me that when he first went to the court for his testimony at a non-second trial, he met Gutierrez for the first time and went up to say hi to her. And he says that she literally growled at him. And he told me that's when he knew it was not going to be a good day.
Now, you know, the flip side of this, interestingly, was that she was actually very kind to Adnan the entire time. He never saw this side of her. Anytime he interacted with her, spoke to her, she was always very reassuring and kind, and she was never aggressive with him, which is a good thing, I suppose. But at the same time, there was this real big disconnect. He had no idea how she was interacting with the family, and we certainly didn't want to tell him because that would have made him nervous. And we just thought, you know what? You have to leave her alone. She's like a legal giant. Let her do her thing. I wonder now, though, if it might have been a good idea that we had told him and if he had talked to her about it, if that would have made a difference. But I don't know.
There's another case we didn't discuss on the Tina episode that it's a bit more speculative, but it certainly involves a client claiming that his experience with Gutierrez was not at all copacetic. This was the Anthony Gray case. It was from earlier in Gutierrez's career. Specifically, on October 7th, 1991, Anthony Gray pleaded guilty to both first-degree murder and first-degree rape. These were crimes that he allegedly committed with other co-conspirators. But then on December 20th, 1991, Gray moved to withdraw that plea for a few reasons. First, he claimed it wasn't voluntary, that he hadn't been told by his attorney the consequences of his plea. Second, he claimed that Gutierrez only met with him for 10 minutes in lockup prior to his bond review hearing, and then only for another 45-minute session before he pleaded guilty at a later date. Third, he claimed that Gutierrez told him she would hire a private investigator to investigate the case and assist in it, but that she, in fact, never hired a PI. And then fourth, his claim, which was verified, was that he was borderline mentally retarded and only pleaded guilty because the prosecutors were threatening him with a death penalty. Gray, though, was unsuccessful in withdrawing that plea. He was later unsuccessful in appealing his conviction, despite the fact that the other alleged co-conspirators were all acquitted, with the judge in one case, in fact, throwing out the charges, finding there wasn't even enough evidence that a juror could possibly return a guilty verdict. Part of the problem for Gray was that his appellate attorney, Michael Kent, had failed to file an appeal or even standard court motions. But then we can go to 1999, the same year that Gutierrez started representing Adnan. A few months before that, Gray was released because the state's attorney actually agreed with Gray's new attorney that Gray was not guilty at all of the crimes charged. This comes from a Baltimore Sun article on February 9th, 1999. Fingerprints found at the crime scene did not match Gray's or those of the other suspects. No evidence existed that Gray or the others had been in the victim's car, which had been stolen after the killing, and DNA evidence recovered from the scene did not match any of the men. In the article, Gray's new attorney, Joel Katz, goes on to note the following. He contended that Gutierrez should have known about Gray's mental capacity and said he would investigate a malpractice claim against her as well as Kent. Gutierrez did not return a telephone message seeking comment yesterday, but last week told The Sun that Gray's family never mentioned his limited intelligence until after he was sentenced. She said Gray had insisted on pleading guilty. Gray told reporters yesterday that that was untrue. We plan to thoroughly investigate the actions of both attorneys, Katz said. Now, you might recall that this is very similar to the Ong case we discussed in episode 14, where both of these clients are saying, I didn't want to plead guilty, and Gutierrez sort of overrode my judgment. You might wonder what happened with the malpractice claim that Katz talked about. Well, I talked to Katz on the phone. He said, in his mind, she was totally incompetent. The problem was that Gray, right after he was released, he unfortunately stole about $4 of something. And therefore, that kind of put the brakes in the malpractice action. So again, this is kind of speculative. We have what's reported in the article. We know that Gray was eventually released. But is it a case where Gutierrez lied about hiring a PI? Is it a case where she only met with him briefly and somehow didn't realize his mental retardation? Again, no investigation, but this is another troubling case where there are allegations of misconduct on behalf of Gutierrez.
Another Twitter question comes to us from Karen Santani, whose Twitter handle is at catch64. And Karen asks, at what time did Adnan and the family realize that Christina Gutierrez was a bad choice of attorney? After the conviction? And I think what happened really when it all kind of clicked was when I first spoke to Asia, and that was after the conviction. The day he was convicted, I spoke to Adnan. I went and visited him. And I just pressed him and I said, gosh, this, you know, I can't believe, first of all, you were convicted, but this all came down to just that little bit of time after school and pinning down where you were. And that's when he first raised, you know, Asia. And I had never heard her name before. And he said, well, you know, there was this girl and she says she was with me, but my lawyer said that, you know, her dates didn't check out or something. And I just don't know. And I said, you know what, let me just talk to her. Let me see what happened here. And I went and I found Asia. Adnan forwarded me the letter she had written. And I think within a couple of weeks, I met her. And that was the day that that's the only time I've ever met her. And she told me, and my brother was there, that Gutierrez never contacted me, that nobody has ever contacted me about the letters that I wrote. And she, I think, thought that she was just not useful to the case. And I was stunned. I was stunned because that's when I realized that, you know, how big of a ball had been dropped in this case, that his only potential alibi witness had never been contacted by any attorney, anybody from her law firm, period. And so I frantically, you know, got an affidavit from her and attempted, you know, told his family, told him this is what happened. And I think that's when everybody realized that we had to let her go. But also after the conviction, Adnan was unable to get a hold of Gutierrez. I think for a week or 2 weeks, he kept trying to call her office. She just wouldn't return his calls. She wouldn't go see him. And that kind of all culminated, I think, in about a week or 10 days later, I can't remember, that the family just wrote her a letter saying that we are firing you, and also notifying the court that they are firing Christina. So Adnan's got his lawyer now, Christina Gutierrez, but he has no idea what's going on in Tina's life and career. None of us do. No one knows she's sick or handling over half a dozen murder cases that span the country, and everyone is counting on her to do the job she's been paid for. Paid very well for, by the way, over six figures in cash. Now comes the time when she'll either make or break Adnan's case, the trial prep and discovery period. And here is when the games begin between the prosecution and defense. It's pretty amazing, actually, despite hundreds of ethical and procedural rules, how much both defense and prosecuting attorneys can get away with. But it's not only amazing, it's sometimes also enraging. Because while attorneys play their cat and mouse games, the life and liberty of the defendant hangs in the balance. Next time on Undisclosed. A special thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, to Baluki, who designed our logo, and to Amar Naji, our sound editor. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us online on social media, on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @undisclosedpod. Tweet us your questions and comments using the #undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.